Guys, it's usually the case when I do one of these question and answer sessions, I have more questions than I'm going to be able to get to, which is good because that way, hopefully, they'll invite me back. I could take another Florida vacation. But let's see. We'll do some of the questions. It seems that our derech and shir is to be very quick to argue with Gedolei Rosh Yeshivas of previous doros. Why isn't it preferable to devote our energies towards understanding them instead of blazing a new mahalach? Also, wouldn't it be l'chatchila to learn svarim of Gedolim that we learn from directly and therefore have a deeper regesh of respect and yira for them, which would make it easier to strive to understand them? I very much enjoyed this question because compared to the rest of the world, we are like 1,000 times less likely to argue with the previous generations. But somehow, even what we do is too much. You know, it's once somebody told me, I consider him a very unreliable source, but he told me the name of a pretty chashuv, a person who will remain nameless, primarily because I don't believe he ever said it, at least not the way that it was reported to me. But that he said that the reason why we learn the Ketzos and the Nesivos is to find out what their questions are. But we don't really pay attention to their answers because we could come up with better answers since we have the advantage of Reb Chaim's Lomdus, Reb Chaim's Derech. So I said to the guy, if you have the advantage of Reb Chaim's Derech, why do you need the Ketzos and the Sivis to find out the questions? Why don't you figure out your own questions? But what I believe the Rosh Hashiva probably really did say was that even though you would think that we have no business even attempting to argue with the Ketzos and the Sivis and to say a different teretz, but since we have Reb Chaim's Lomdus and Reb Chaim's tools of Lomdus, it elevates to the point that we are able to say a different teretz. But not that our terutzim are better and we don't have to pay attention to them. So we're not so fast to argue with the Ketzos and the Sivis. We will argue with Rosh Hashivas. And the truth of the matter is it's always been the case in learning. You go throughout the generations, people always argue with previous generations, people who are great. And I'm just doing right now in my blatcher in Queens, which I just did over video. It's very interesting. There's a Rabbeinu Chananel who holds one way, and the Rif argues with Rabbeinu Chananel, and then the Rambam argues with the Rif in very strong terms also. He says, my Rabbeim said something that's ain't a roi l'shaman. It's not roi to hear them. And then there's Rashi is like the Rif. So Rabbeinu Chananel was the Rif's Rebbe, and the Rif was sort of like the Rambam's Rebbe, or Father Rebbe, and they each argued with each other, you know, going back. But we do try to treat it with respect. I do think we do make an effort to figure out what the Rosh Hashivas are saying. We don't just want to argue with them. But in the end of the day, growth and learning requires exercising your own intellect and your own Havana. And sort of like Ein L'Danish Rosh Hashivas, you have to be Marcus Makomo, you have to know where you are, you know. We have to be able to understand what you know and what you don't know. But if you limit yourself to only working to understand what they say, it's too limiting. You will not be able to get into the Torah as much as you can. You're hopeful that somebody will be on your side. And sometimes you'll find that when you work on a sugya very hard and you argue with somebody who's really greater than you, you do enough reaches, you might find somebody else who agrees with you. So, you know, there are different ways of looking at it. I'm sure I always tell my Talmidim, you know, when I argue with Reb Shimon or something like that, do I think that if I met Reb Shimon and I went head to head with him, do I think that I'm going to win the argument? Of course not. What I'm hoping for is that he shouldn't burst out laughing. And he should say, you know, I thought of your mahalach, and that's such a bad idea, but we have to exercise our own kolcha. So we try to get a balance. We try to tackle work on what the early Doros say. We try to limit ourselves and don't think that we can argue with the Shach in Shikul Hadas or even the Ketzos and the Sivis, except Peshas Etchak, when you really have to make a parnasa. But at the same time, you do have to exercise your own das. It seems that our primary focus in Musar is Musar B'Spilus and Musar Shmuzin. I would add a third component, which I guess call Yediyas HaMusar, just being aware of all the different concepts that are brought down in the Musar Svarim and the sources. Is there a reason why it isn't encouraged so much to do cheshbon nefesh during Musa Seder or to brainstorm etzes and tachbulos at that time? It seems to me that would be more productive. I think that, first of all, there's some questions here, hopefully we'll get to it, about the idea of Mesorah and changing Mesorah and so on. The starting point really is that we are following a Mesorah. We're not like reinventing the wheel of what comes what and where. And the idea of cheshbon nefesh and tachbulos is very personal. Each person is different, but it is something that's very important. But it wasn't the purpose of a Musa Seder. That doesn't mean people shouldn't spend time on it. But you can't, by the way, become a Baal Musar and a Talmud Chacham, and if you limit yourself to punching the clock, I do my hours 9 to 5, and then Chas V'Shalom never do anything more. And life is all day. You're living your entire life, and you got to be aware of things and listen and so on. So the purpose of the Musa Seder is not for this function, but it is an important function. Counterintuitively, Reb David said that people often think that the harder job is coming up all with these takbulos and tricks because it's so hard to figure out what the kochas and nefesh are and what's going to work and what's going to help and so on. And the Musar and Musar B'Spalos, what's the big deal? But he said it's really lehepach. Because the real thing that you need to grow in Musar is commitment, consistency, working on it day in, day out. Even when you fall down, you pick yourself up, don't give up, keep plugging. That's what breeds success. Where does that come from? That comes from motivation. It's something that's really important to you. What makes it so important to you? That's where the Musa Seder comes in, with these spilus and the Chachmas HaMusar and so on. And when you really understand how important it is, you'll figure out the Takpulis and the Eitzis. If this doesn't work, you try something else, trial and error, you get Eitzis. But to keep pushing, to keep plugging, to keep going, that's not so easy. And that's where a lot of the Toeles, Musar V'Spilus is. It's next to the pile. I'm very unclear as to when a new idea is considered breaking the Mesorah and when it's acceptable because it isn't in Stira. Can the Rav Shiva please elaborate? He has some interesting examples here. A few examples. Rebbe feels giving Shmuzin on Kedusha Shabbos V'Yantiv or Maimorim in Machshava would be very helpful for the Talmidim. Would that be an issue? What if it was outside of Seder? What about borrowing Eitzis or Skulos from Chasidus or Kabbalah? What about giving shir differently if you feel that it would be a better shir that way and the Talmidim would benefit more? What about learning halachas in Eben Ezer, Chosh HaMishpat, instead of just Aruch Chaim, I think he means, or areas of Midos during Mishnah Berurah Seder? Right, okay. Rosh Yeshiva's clarification on this would be appreciated very much. I'm not sure if I can give him an entire clarification, but the idea, so to speak, of picking and choosing the best of both worlds. I'll take the best of Chassidus and the best of Machshava and the best of Musar and the best of this and the best of that. Everything else will come up with this conglomerate, which is just going to be la'ela, la'ela, la'ela. Of course, you have to ask yourself a question like, why weren't all these other people doing that? But it doesn't, to do that, you really have to master all of them. If you really, truly understand what everything's all about, you might be able to create some conglomerate. You might discover that they don't mix and they don't work with each other. So to think that you could kind of do that is extremely unrealistic. And halavai that we should be able to understand, one mahalach. Now, can you do things a little differently? You can. So Rishu used to talk about tweaking, changing, tweaking. My understanding of that is when you take the yesodos of your Mesorah and you try to apply it to a situation, and what you're trying to do is to follow how the Mesorah would best be applicable to these circumstances. That's what Yeshiva called tweaking. I think an example of that, which was a pretty big tweak, is in learning, not so much in Musar, the Rav David Shiurim were a lot more conventional Yeshiva Shishurim in the sense, he did Rambams, he did the Rishonim, he didn't do a lot of Achronim and delving in so much into the Achronim. Rosh Yeshiva did, and we do it now, a lot more working in the Achronim. That was a change. Rosh Yeshiva did have an authorization, at least the way he interpreted from Rav David about that, But he said, but what we're trying to do is to take the Mahalakhan learning to understand the Shaka Vitarya, the assembly line, Minei Obey, what's going on, and applying it to our generation where we don't have the breadth of understanding in the Rishon, and we need more tools to build with. So you stand on the shoulders of the Achronim and you dig into what they're saying, and we're able to do what the Mesorah wants us to do. Sometimes you're doing something that's different than the Mesorah, but we think it will serve a toelus. So that's something you have to be very cautious about. But it should be said on more than one occasion that the Mesorah is the Muchzak, and a Motzi Mechaber Olav Haraya. If you want to change things, you have to have a Raya that could be Motzi Mama. So maybe this would be better. Maybe it would be. You have a Svara, maybe it would be better to have a shorter Musa Seder. Maybe it would be better to have a longer Musa Seder. And you'll come up with Svaras. Like a shorter Musa Seder would be better, a longer Musa Seder would be better. They may be good Svaras. Are you going to be Motzi Mama? Do you take it to the bank? Maybe not. There's a tzad the other way too. So you have to be pretty sure of yourself, and you also have to really have an understanding of what the Mesorah is all about. Rishivi used to say, you know, we just talked about recently in Queens, Rishivi used to say that, you know, if you really don't hear your Rebbe's view, you know, different numbers, 10%, 20%, I don't know, I heard different numbers, different times, then you have the right to argue. He says, that's true. But that's only if most of the time you do hear your Rebbe's views and you understand it and you're on the level that you have a daya. So you can't tell, like, a kasha from a teretz and a raya from, you're not, so who are you? You have a daya? I don't hear what the Rebbe says. I'm 14 years old in high school and I don't hear what the Rebbe says, so I'm going to argue. So you're not a bar hachi. You got to be in the ballpark, first of all. But so we move cautiously. But the idea of sort of like taking the best of all the different things, I don't think is a realistic mahalach, because people don't really understand it. There are certain things a person wants to do in his spare time. He has an interest. You know, it's probably not worse than some other things that people do in their spare time. But he shouldn't think that because he has a handle on, I'm going to enhance the Mesorah. Why doesn't the Chabad Chaim system/Rabbeim push the love of Torah and try to exude it as in done in other yeshivas? Wouldn't it benefit the Talmidim, especially in high school? I don't know if it's especially in high school, but it's Medrash Kolel. I think we should. I hope we do. I think what we don't, it is a very important part of Chinuch. Rebbe should come across that he enjoys Torah. Learning is not just an obligation, it's something he loves to do. And it is a very important message. What we don't exude, probably, and this is probably where the question comes from, is we don't make this great push on hasmada per se, hours learned. First of all, Yeshiva didn't define hasmada purely in terms of hours. It's intensity, it's effort, how much of your kochos you put into it. Sometimes that means less hours. I read a story a few years ago. There's a biography. It was written in Hebrew, so it was slow reading. I would love it in the English translation. And I don't remember if it was on Rav Chaim or Rav Elvel, on the Brisker dynasty, but I didn't get that far. I was only up to Rav Chaim anyway. It went all the way back to the beginnings of the Brisker dynasty. But there's a story that Rav Chaim learned in Volozhin. He got married to one of the Rosh Yeshiva's daughters when he was in Volozhin. He did not have an official position in the yeshiva. He was just learning as kolel, whatever you want to call it. I don't think they paid kolel, but he was learning. But unofficially, he gathered a lot of talmidim. People gravitated to him, and he had a whole following of people who were, in essence, his unofficial talmidim. One of those talmidim was Rav Shimon Shkop. Rav Shimon had a relative, it doesn't say exactly who he was, who kept giving Rav Shimon mussar for spending so much time with Rav Chaim. He says, Rav Chaim's a batlan. And you have such kochos, you shouldn't be wasting your time with this batlan. So why was he a batlan? Because he used to learn a five-hour morning seder, and then it doesn't say how long a break in between, then a five-hour afternoon seder, then he would go out and take a walk. He would take a break. It doesn't say how long the break is either. I suspect it wasn't that long. He would take a spatzir and go take a walk. What a batlan. A guy wasting his time. That's the guy you're hanging out with? So word got back to Rav Chaim that they had this complaint about him. And he said, I don't know what they want from me. I really strained myself in Iyun my havana during that, I take a need a break, so I need to take a relax a little bit. Anyway, years later, when Reb Chaim became the Rav of Brisk, there was a whole ceremony inaugurating him into Brisk, and at that time, Rav Shimon's relative lived in Brisk. He was a balabas there, and Rav Shimon already had a yeshiva, and it was in Grudner, it was something before that, I don't know the exact timing, but he was a Rosh Yeshiva, and he came to Brisk for this event, and he meets his relative there, and he says to his relative, "You know why I'm a Rosh Yeshiva and you're a balabas? Because I hung out with that Batlin and you didn't." So that's not batala, that's hasmada. But that we do, Shiva did have a concern, and we shared the concern that sometimes when you push hasmada just hours, you end up pushing people into something that they're not ready for, and they could have a tendency to burn out. And really, it should come from within. You should encourage, you should inspire, and people should, if they want to take on extra learning, it's because they feel that they want to, and not because they're being subject to that pressure. But people should have such a hasag in mind. They shouldn't think that I should get by, and I'm doing, you have to be in touch with yourself. You have to read yourself. But it is this is a card with a whole bunch of questions. We're going to take one more, some good questions here, but I'm going to take one more. I don't want to take all the questions. A person has to miss some Seder. Am I getting an Avera for Bittul Torah or having a negative Hashpah, or is it no Avera because I'm doing the right thing? Of course, the assumption is that you're making the right decision. That has to, you know, be sure that it is the right decision. Maybe you have to be Shalais if you're not sure, what the right decision is. Sort of the question is, we say Talmud Torah is Kenegad Kulam. So let's say a person, let's take a classic, the brought down Klor in Shulchan Aruch, that there's a chesed sheyefshar de acherim, not so easy to define that, but if it does exist, so you're supposed to be mevatel the Torah to do that chesed. Are you gaining, losing, what happens? I'm doing chesed. Chesed is a big mitzvah. Talmud Torah is a bigger mitzvah. So it could be that I'm losing, right? I'm losing schar. I downgraded from Talmud Torah to chesed sheyefshar de acherim. The truth of the matter is that's not relevant. So let's say you are. But this is what a Kadosh Baruch Hu wants you to do. Have you decided I'm not going to do the chesed because I want to learn Torah and I want to get more schar? You're not going to get more schar. It's going to be an avera. And there's a Maimer Chazal. It says, Oy lohem ledor shenase schuyosav chavosav. Woe to the generation that your mitzvahs become averas. And the Pasuk says, Mibikesh zos miyedchem remos chatzei roi. Who asked you to be all irregular? Kodesh Baruch Hu says, you're trampling my courtyard. It's a mitzvah. But they did it the wrong way. The mitzvah became an avera. So it isn't, you have to know first of all what the right thing is to do. And it's essentially not relevant whether you're gaining in schar or not gaining in schar. It's not a question of schar. It's a question of doing what Hashem wants you to do. If you're not doing what Hashem wants you to do, you're not getting the schar. The truth is, Rav Zundel says in his letter, it's appended to the end of the Or Yisrael, that you don't lose. But you have to be careful. That's not the cheshbon. You know, you sometimes have the guy say, well, look, you know, I don't have to worry about doing this chesed because I'm not going to lose. Zundel says, you know, you do the right thing. That's not part of the cheshbon. That's after the cheshbon. First, you have to decide what is the right thing to do. And if nimnu v'gamru, that's the right thing to do, then taka, he says, you don't lose. I had I don't know what to make of it. I heard a story. I have a feeling I know what really happened. You know, I'm reading into these stories. But the story was, I think it was the Chazon Ish, I'm not sure, I think so if I remember correctly, that he had a kolel, and there was a fellow who was like mamish, a masvid, he was first one, never a second late, ever. And one day he saunters into morning Seder, like an hour, and he's beaming, he's very happy. He says, well, knew what happened. So basically, on the way to Seder, somebody was falling, fell into some, I don't know what it was, a river, this and that, was drowning, he saved their life. But that's why he came late to Seder. But he was very happy because he saved a life. So he said to him, if you had been Zocha, somebody else would have saved a life and you would have been able to come to Seder. But I have a problem with that. I don't think we should feel that way. I mean, there is such a thing, a person is supposed to feel bad if he doesn't have the opportunity to learn Torah. But you're also supposed to feel happy that I'm doing Ratzon Hashem. Hashem wants me to do a bunch of different things. And maybe there's certain times he doesn't want me to learn Torah, so I'm doing what Hashem wants me to do. There should be a simcha from that. Every time you're doing something else, Nebuch, I have to take a lulav and esrog now, I can't learn. No, even if it's Hashem is simcha, you should be happy that you're doing the mitzvah. So there's a balance there. You should recognize it could be, this is my interpretation of the story, that Chazon Ish felt that he was a little bit too happy. You're coming in dancing, Kilu, he saved a life. You didn't save the life. The life would have been saved anyway. You were the shliach. That was your mitzvah. Okay, there should be a certain level of simcha, but it was too happy. So he's pointing out to him, it came at a cost. You know, Hashem put you in that position. That's my interpretation. I can't say I wasn't there. I don't know. Heard the story 15th hand. I don't know what's going on there, but I don't think people should go through, you know, life feeling depressed about doing what Kadosh Baruch Hu wants you to do. You should be happy. That's all he wants. I remember once getting a question, you know, how do you balance, you know, the all kinds of union yeshiva, all kinds of opportunity for chesed come up. And it's hard to know what's a yevsha, not a yevsha, possible this. How do you balance, you know, the doing chesed with the learning? So my answer was, it really depends. If you feel like you really want to do the chesed, I think you should maybe think about doing more learning. If you think you really want to do the learning, maybe you should think about doing more chesed. Because the chances are, whatever your natural cheshek is, that's where you're going overboard. You know, and the other side might be getting the short shrift. So it's a hard thing to balance. Isn't the smartphone war too hard to fight? Should we just accept it and use it for the good things that it has, such as Torah Shirim, Siddur apps, etc.? What, if not, what does Rebbe think is so bad? I'm not sure exactly what he means, but I have a little bit of a difference of opinion. There's this organization that has a lot of like Torah Shirim online. They call it TorahAnytime.com. You might have heard of them. Actually, I have a Shirim there online, you know, TorahAnytime.com. So their slogan is TorahAnytime.com, God's reason for the internet. So I feel that they should change their slogan. And the slogan should be, if you're going to have the internet anyway, you might as well at least learn something. Somehow I think though it wouldn't work so well for fundraising. But I don't presume to know God's reason for the internet. I suspect it's the Nisoyon of our generation. I'm not so sure it's for TorahAnytime.com. But it is a pervasive, you know, it's a pervasive problem. There's so many things. People often associate the problems of the internet with things like schmutz and stuff like that. But that's only one piece of the picture. It was in a high school here in Miami. They asked the question, why do the Rebbe keep hawking about the internet? Why don't you talk about something important like Lashon Hara? So I said, okay, I'm going to talk about Lashon Hara. Once upon a time, when a person wanted to speak Lashon Hara, he had to find a friend to tell his Lashon Hara to. If the guy's not around, you couldn't speak Lashon Hara. So it wasn't so easy. A lot of times, you want to speak, and there's nobody around, you couldn't speak Lashon Hara. By the time you found the guy, you got over the Nisayon. So then Sutton invented the telephone. So on the telephone, you could pick up the phone. When your urge strikes you, your friend's not there, you could call him and speak Lashon Hara. But telephone wasn't so good. You see, first of all, sometimes the line's busy. Sometimes the guy's not home. Call the telephone, he's not there, doesn't answer the phone. It worked a little bit, but not so great. So they invented the cell phone. So now he has a cell phone, the phone is with him all the time, you know, and you can go home wherever you want. But still not perfect. Sometimes even the cell phone could be busy, or sometimes he's in the middle of something, he doesn't hear the phone, or he doesn't answer the phone, and you have to wait. And then it could be by the time he calls you back, you'll get over the Nisayon and you're not going to tell the Lashon Hara. So we invented texting. So if he doesn't answer the phone, you could text the Lashon Hara right away. But the truth be told, texting is a little bit cumbersome. You got to text the thing. And in the end of the day, what do you accomplish? You tell Lashon Hara to one person. That's okay, but it's not great. So we invented group texting. So you can have a whole list of names, you know, whether it's WhatsApp or this or that, the other thing. And with one text message, you could send it to so many people. ah, but we're not done yet. Because self, there's still a limit on the group name, pre-existing names and so on, so we invented social media. Now anybody could come onto your Facebook page or your Twitter account. So if Donald Trump wants to tell Lashon Hara, 9 million people will get that Lashon Hara almost instantaneously. So I'm talking about Lashon Hara. Bittelsman, Leitzanus. You know, pieces of covet for things that require covet. That's what Leitzanus is. There are so many things. There was a fellow who made a presentation. We had an alumni breakfast. And this guy, who's a working person, not a Marbit Stara, and he runs a company with a partner. He runs a company. And he was talking to them how he gave up his smartphone. And actually, he did it because of his partner. His partner in business gave up his smartphone, and he was encouraging him, if you give up your smartphone, you will be more efficient. The business will run better. And he did not do it for religious reasons. So he said, okay. He gave up his smartphone. Why does the business run better? He said, when you have a smartphone, every time you get an email, they expect an instant response. But sometimes you don't have the answer yet. He's on the road, meeting with a client. He has to interrupt to answer to the thing. The client doesn't like it. It distracts the train of thought. He didn't really have an answer yet. He gets back to the office. He researches, sees what's going on, and he could solve the problem. He says it's a constant distraction. You can't focus on anything. He said, I take him at his word, he didn't do anything inappropriate on the smartphone, but he began to realize how much time he was spending just looking up news items, sports items, surfing the web, nothing bad. He didn't realize how much time it was taking up in his day. All of a sudden, he had more time available. Then he said, I'm playing such and such a game. I wasn't familiar with the game, but the whole audience laughed. So everybody in the audience knew what game he was talking about. So I forgot already. You probably know it too, but I don't remember the game. So he said, all this time that was taking up. So what happened? His clients, his customers, knew that they're not getting an instant response to your email, but he'll call you back within a reasonable period of time by the next business day, and usually when he calls you back, it's with a solution. They appreciated that. They'd rather not get the instant response. When you have it, they're angry. Why don't you get back to me? When they really, he doesn't have it, and he'll get back to you when he's back in the office, but when he gets back, it's something substantive. It's that. People like it better. It was better for his customer relations. He said he didn't realize on his family life what had changed when he came home. When he came home, he was actually paying attention to his wife and to his kids, and obviously had something to do with his family. It's affecting the entire quality of life. And it has psychological effects. The National Institute for Health just allocated a few months ago $300 million initial funding, and there's going to be much, much more before they're done, doing what's called a longitudinal study. A longitudinal study is where they take people and follow them through life and see what happens. And they're trying to correlate screen time, as they call it, with mental health, physical health, and other issues. They've already noticed a correlation between the level of teenage depression and suicide and the level of use of screen time, because it takes away from real personal interactions. So they funded this study. It's going to be 15, 20 years, whatever it is. The study is, I could tell you the results right now. I think they can too. But it's not official until you do a study. It takes away from all the things in life that are meaningful. It's not the same. It's not the same. Your friend on social media is not a friend. It's just, you know, somebody has an interest in what you're putting on your posting, so you have to keep them interested. So you have to figure out what the people want to watch, and that's what you put on your thing. It's not a true relationship. So there's a lot of devastation. Now, can we get rid of the smartphone? Probably not. But as we say in Queens, kol hamemayit harezem meshubach. The less you can have to do with it, the better, and if you could avoid it altogether for a period of time, okay. Now it's becoming a problem is because the phone services aren't supporting. I have my nice little dumb phone here. I usually don't take out my phone in the basement, but just to demonstrate. It's Verizon. Verizon allegedly is not going to support it anymore at a certain point in time. You know, so I don't know what I'm going to do. But whatever can be done to be mine, and if you must have the phone, you know, then it should be as controlled and as protected as possible, but But it's not even just the protections of things which are inherently bad, it's just the way it invades your life and changes your relationships. So it is really the challenge of the generation. You know, it really is. And I think it cannot be understated, you know, what type of a challenge it is. Do I have a simple solution? No, but I will tell you one thing. If I can remember his name, Gottlieb, what's his first name? The guy who founded TAG. Does anybody remember his name? I think his name is Gottlieb. There was a meeting, this goes back a nice number of years, not a huge number of years, there's a meeting at the home of Ruchaim Epstein Zatzal in the Bar Park about the internet. And they were inviting all different Rosh Hashivas to the meeting, and I really decided I wasn't going to the meeting. Because, you know, I didn't think it was any great toilets in being in the meeting. I don't need to hear another bunch of drushes from various gedolim about how bad the internet is. I agree with them. You know? But then I got a personal phone call from one of the gedolim, and I really couldn't say no, so I came. So I was happy I came. Because of this Gottlieb guy. There was all these drushes, get the internet okay, they were nice. But they were in Yiddish, but I could follow enough Yiddish to get by. I got the, some that one was saying, he said, he had a few different interesting things. First of all, he opened my eyes to some of the challenges I didn't even think of. Like something which is relatively, like just talking about just the idea of a cell phone. He said that he had I don't know if it was him, maybe he's telling somebody else's story, but a young lady who had been somewhat off the derech in high school and was coming back, and her home situation was not such a healthy environment for her, and she was staying in somebody else's house, which she was doing very well. One day she's waiting at a bus stop, and the fellow comes by the bus stop and says, "I'm sorry, you know, my battery ran out on my phone. I need to make a phone call. I just borrow your phone for a second." So she said, "Okay." So he takes the phone, makes a phone call, whatever, gives the phone back. That evening, she gets a text message. It says, "I'm the guy who borrowed your phone this afternoon, and I'd really like to meet you. If you're interested, please text me back. If you don't text me back, I won't bother you again." Something like that. So what did he do? He took the phone and called his phone. Now he has her phone number. He didn't say anything to her. So that means he had enough hesitation and reservation not to say anything to her directly. But texting is easy. So Baruch Hashem, she didn't respond. She said a few months earlier, maybe she would have responded. So it creates, you know, and that's not even internet. That's just, you know, the technology. It's so like, wow, like I never thought of a thing like that. But he said one thing. It's not Chofetz Chaim Rabosa. I'm calling somebody outside all the time. He's not even a Rosh Hashiva or anything like that. It's not Mukhruk. It's not Pshat. It's okay. But don't ask me any kashas on the shmooze. It's not a shmooze. But he said that it says, the ksil, the Gemara says, the ksil goes into the Beis Medrash, and he says, the Torah is too big. I can't learn Torah. And he gives up. The Chacham says, I'll learn a pasuk, shana, perek ayom, perek l'machar, pasuk l'machar, do one thing today, one thing tomorrow, prut to prut to mitzarif l'kis gadol. Before you know it, you learned a lot of Torah. So he said, the Chacham doesn't say, "What are you talking about? The Torah is no big deal. It's easy." No, he agreed. Torah is too big. But I don't have to learn the whole Torah at once. Let me do one perek today, one perek time before. You know, prutim, it's time for the kiss gadol. So, but if you were to come in and say, the Torah is no big deal, you're just as big a ksil as the other guy. So he says the same thing with the internet. If a person comes in and says, the internet is overwhelming, I give up, I can't help it. That's a ksil. But the person says, "That's no big deal. I can have it. It's not a problem." He's also a ksil. The pshat is, internet is a big deal. And maybe I can't solve all the problems, but I can solve something. So whatever I can solve, I can solve. Puta putum, it's time to get go. You take care of this problem, take care of that. Another problem comes up, you try that. Okay, you keep plugging away. So you never give up the fight, Rabosai. Will we win the war? I don't know about that, but we'll win various battles. And maybe that is winning the war. And at the end of the day, we need to see out the Dishmaya, Kesh Baruch Hu, but the attitude always has to be that the internet is a dangerous instrument. And called Mamaze Mishubach, we have to, and you know, again, and to hold out as best as you can and to do as minimal as you can. So do I think it's bad? The answer is yes. Okay, Chofetz Chaim, age of 24, Shri Shiduchim, arbitrary. doesn't that really come down to the Bachar, his parents, the Rebbe, in regard to starting earlier or later? The number 24 is not arbitrary, but it's not exactly what it's sometimes represented. The number 24 is not the age to begin Shiduchim. The background of the number 24 is, actually, it's a Kedushin, right? It's a Gemara in Kedushin. So, of course, you learn the Gemara in Kedushin, you'll find that the age to get married is 18. And I actually had a parent who was upset over the fact that his son was not getting involved in Shiduchim. He's 21 or 22 years old. And he sent me a letter. He published Svarim, this guy. I don't know how big a Talmud Chacham he was, but at least he thought he was. He had some other complaints about the yeshiva too, but I answered also, but that's not relevant to our discussion. But he said that how could you tell people not to start dating at 21 or whatever, 22? Chazal say, it's 18. He says, first of all, don't start with Chabetz Chaim. I said to him, because Lakewood has a policy, they call it the freezer, that a person comes to Lakewood for the first half a year, or whatever, roughly half a year, he's not supposed to be involved in Shiduchim. Everybody who comes to Lakewood is above the age of 18. Right? So somebody decided that. It wasn't just us. So, not this Chavetz Chaim thing. So basically, the Rush says that if a person's learning Torah and he's afraid that getting married will take away from his learning, he's allowed to delay his learning. The Achronim say, but you can't delay forever. Because the Gemara brings down that Misha Hashko Navsha B'Torah Ben Azai, he's Pater from the Mitzvah Peruvu. He's obviously a Yachid B'Doro. So it's not for everybody. So you're not Pater. So what's the Shir? Because they don't say the Shir. So the Chabetz Chaim says that a person should try to make sure that he's married by no later than 25. So Rishiva said, you have to do Ishtadlus. A year is reasonable Ishtadlus to get married by 25. So what he's really saying is you shouldn't push it off later than 24 if you want to push it off because of your learning. By the way, the Rishivas Hashara turns out to be statistically accurate. When all these Shidduch people, that's probably where this question comes from, they're promoting guys going out younger, did their statistics and the studies and so on. One of the stats they came up with, although I don't really know how they calculated this, but they allege that the average time for a boy from the time he starts dating until he gets married is 0.92 years. So almost a year. But the reason why I don't understand how they get it is that some people don't get married at all, or last reason, how do they count them in the stats? I don't know how they do this. It must be a way of discounting the outliers. I don't know how they work it out. But that's what they allege. But But it does depend on the circumstance and so on, the situation and the person. And, it is, but there, it's not always so healthy to have this social pressure to get married younger, because maybe people aren't ready for it and create shalom bias issues. Or maybe it's going to affect their learning, the time they spend in learning, the quality of their learning. When this first came up a number of years ago, the Shiva Zetzal was still alive, and actually Rav Shmuel Berenbaum Zetzal was involved in this. And they had a letter similar to the letters that they're publishing today. They wanted Rav Shmuel Berenbaum to sign it, and he wouldn't sign it until he found out what the Rosh Hashiva held. He was a very big fan of the Rosh Hashiva. And this delegation came, so I did the intake, because Rosh Hashiva wasn't always up to taking these types of meetings, I guess. I was extremely skeptical going into the meeting. For years, the boys are older than the girls, and all of a sudden it's a problem. I was very, but they presented very persuasive statistics. It was also extremely insulting, I have to tell you, because they did surveys all over the place. Yeshivas I never heard of were surveyed, about the age, how many singles, and then all the girls' schools. And included in the girls' schools that were surveyed was Shevach High School, which is the girls like Beis Yaakov in Kew Garden Hills. But Chabetz Chaim was not included. So if you tell me they never heard of Queens, okay, it wouldn't bother me so much. But they knew about Shevach, and we're not on the survey. But okay. But it did seem to bear it out. So I brought the information to the Rosh Yeshiva, and the Rosh Yeshiva said he wouldn't sign such a letter. He said, first of all, maybe they're not ready. So he said, maybe you'll solve the Shidduch crisis, you'll have a Shalom Bayis crisis. And the second thing he said was, who's taking Achrayas for the lost learning? He says, I'm not ready to do that. So this was conveyed back to Rav Shmuel Berenbaum, and he wouldn't sign the letter either. And they ended up writing this totally pirate letter that basically said something to the effect that if a person feels he's ready to get married, he shouldn't hold back just because his friends aren't doing it yet. That's really not the same. But that's what it was about. But Lamaisa, it is really a personal, you know, individual thing. And sometimes there are situations where you can even push it past 24, but usually that's not so pashut. At 24, you really have a chiyuv, to do it. So there's a big veering. Well, he's no longer mostly in Queens. Now he moved out of Queens, but we're trying to get him to support the yeshiva a little bit. He had tinnitus, he's very involved in this, and Nasi and so on. He was one of his Rebbe really was in favor of it, and he was very big gung-ho on it. So Rabbi Harris went to see him once, to try and get money. So he said, we have a different way that we're contributing towards the solution of the yeshiva problem. So we start branches in all these outlying communities, and we get people who never would be in the yeshiva world. They were heading a different direction. And we get them in, and then they come, and now they're part of the yeshiva. There's more boys in the pool because of us. So it was worth it. He increased his donation. He liked that. He said, but you should do the other thing too. It was a good argument, no? Does chinuch hamusar work if a person does not have the right intention? For example, I make sure to come on time to morning service to get my little chocolate. Was there some chocolate incentive? And it happens to be that I'm also being on time to Seder. Will I benefit from coming on time in terms of appreciating Limudei Torah more? The answer to that is, there is a concept when we talk shelo lishma, bo lishma, and a person does grow from lo lishma. The Marsha really says that a person has to have a certain attitude to grow. There might be some benefit anyway, but certainly to get the maximum benefit. Most people, the chocolate type of thing is actually a very good example of the right way to use mitok shelo lishma bo lishma. Because in the end of the day, how much is a cup of, what is it, chocolate drink? How much is a cup of chocolate really worth? So you're not really getting a person who really couldn't care less about Seder and doesn't like to learn and does this, I gotta get my chocolate. You know what? I'll spring a few bucks for the chocolate. I'll buy it myself. We're not that poor, these days. But the pshat is, it helps, because that's the kochas hanefesh. So what comes out in a situation like this, it's a mixture of motives. He's not coming just for the chocolate. Even if it is a play a role, and he gets into it, and it's a big thing, there's an element there. Exact percentages you could calculate, can't calculate. An element there, he's coming because, you know what? It's a good thing to come to Seder on time. And you begin to internalize that value, and mitok shelo lishma bo lishma. I once saw, I don't know if he's here right now, thanks to Dr. Jacob, he pushed me to read a certain book. The name is Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. A guy was an Israeli, not a firm guy, but he was a psychologist, economist. He won a Nobel Prize, actually, for his work on economics. And it was mamish full of kochos hanefesh. This guy was amazing, and stuff. So he had a thing about incentives. And they've done studies to sort of demonstrate this. If the incentives are really too big, they don't work as well. Because then the guy is doing it totally shelo lishma. When you give a small incentive, the people internalize the message. Because they look at themselves and say, I did this for a piece of chocolate? I pushed myself out of bed for a nice, warm, comfortable bed in the morning for a piece of chocolate? I did because it's important to come to Minyan on time, to come to Seder on time. So you internalize the value. But if you're giving out, $500, yeah, I got a bed for $500. I absolutely did. I'd do it again for another $500. So then you don't internalize the message as well. So, but Lamaisa, that is really classic. Mitok shelo lishma bo lishma, and a program like that that gives a small incentive, but people like it, and there's a certain, some of it is maybe the covet too. I got the thing and this. I once had a kid in a high school, that's here in Florida, who was extremely talented, a helpful guy, and he made my life so much easier. Like, if we're going to run a Shabbaton, I would put him in charge, and he would take care of so many things that I used to otherwise have to do myself. It was great. But I knew, it was clear to me, what was motivating him was covet. Being the insider, the macher, being close to the menahel, and I'm the guy, you know. And it's clear to me that, but he did a very good job. He involved other people also. He got people involved. He was very nice about it. He wasn't like anything arrogant. But I had this like guilt feeling. I'm feeding into his feeling, you know, for covenant. Maybe it's not such a good thing. But I really wanted to do it because it made my life easier. So I called the Rosh Hashiva. I asked him what he thought about that. So he just said, it's no different than what the Rambam says. When you have a child and you want to get the child to learn, you give him a candy. You're feeding into his taiva. But that's where he's holding. But does he lord it over other people? He said, absolutely not. He's very good. He brings other people in. Is this? No. So then you could do it. Baruch Hashem. But there's a concept. But the more you focus on trying to grow, and the more that those feelings are mixed and have the positive thing, the more you're going to grow, and the faster you're going to grow. So it is a very important. Okay, I think we're sort of out of time, but we'll do one more question anyway. Let's see. It's a really good question, but I'm tired of dealing with it. It's usually in high school. I'll do it anyway. Okay, you talked me into it. I'm not going to read the whole question, but the basic idea is, the idea of wearing hats, is that still applicable today when people in the world in general, hats have disappeared, basically. So, chashev, a businessman, the president, you know, they don't wear hats. It was a big deal. President Kennedy in 1960, when he went to the inauguration without a hat, it was like worldwide news. It was the biggest deal in the world. So, you wouldn't expect anybody to come with a hat. Yeah. So there is, the Yesod HaDavar is that the reason why society today doesn't have hats and other types of things is not because they've changed the definition of covet. It's that they don't really want covet. They want to be casual. They don't want to have covet. They have days in business dressed down. You come in jeans and this. Some businesses are turning away from that already. They find it to be counterproductive. But you know, the idea isn't that, oh, there's a new standard of covet. They're not interested in covet. That shouldn't have an impact on us. We are interested in covet. I think when it comes specifically to head coverings, it could be it's not hats. Maybe it could be a turban. You know, I don't know if it has to be a hat. When it comes specifically to the head coverings, I think that's not societally or cultural base. For example, there's a halach in the Gemara that says, he called the Kresel HaKecha Yisrael, that you should put on shoes when you daven, you shouldn't go barefoot. So Beis Yosef brings down that if you're in a society when you come to the king, you take off your shoes, in Japan, you know, you take off your shoes, then you could daven also without shoes. Because it's culturally based. Head covering, I think, is not culturally based. Why do I say that? Because there is a Torah Kohanim, a Braisa, in Parshas Metzora. The Pasuk says in Metzora, it says, "Begadav yir frumim, v'rosho yir perua, v'al safam ya'ateh." That's the Pasuk. A tzarua has to be mevazeh himself. He has to behave in a degrading fashion. That's part of his tshuva. So begadim yefrumim means his clothes should be torn. Al safam yateh, the last thing, means he should grow his beard and mustache ragged. What's rosho yeh perua? So it's machlokas Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael, and I don't remember who says what. One of them says that the middle of the pasuk is learned from the beginning of the pasuk, and just like the beginning of the pasuk is talking about clothing, so too, the middle of the pasuk is talking about clothing, and it means you should not cover your head. The other mandamer says the middle is learned from the end, just like the end of the pasuk is talking about hair, the middle of the pasuk is talking about hair, and it means you should not cut your hair, not take a haircut. So according to one Tana, the pasuk is telling us the definition of bizayon is rosh hayah perua. You don't have a head covering. It's culturally based. In our society, not covering your hair is covered. So how could the Torah is eternal. How could the pasuk give a formula for bizayon that depends on the culture, depends on the society? So I think it's inherent. this particular aspect of kavod is inherent. It's not. It may depend on the culture side. What kind of hat you wear? Or do you wear a turban? Do you wear a hat? You know, like a green hat or a blue hat or a black hat. I don't know. That might be cultural, but the idea, I think, is inherent. It's not cultural. Okay, Rabosai, you're gonna have to have me back. Hatzlach Rabba, should steig and grow, Torah, Musar, everything else.